Hello, I'm Claire Wright, Professor of Public Engagement at La Trobe University. Welcome to Literary La Trobe, a podcast showcasing the writing and research of La Trobe University's staff, students, adjuncts, and alumni. The recording you're about to hear was made on the 25th of March 2026 at the La Trobe University Library in Melbourne, Australia, on unceded Wurundjeri land. It was part of the Launches at the Library series. In this important and engaging conversation, Professor Julie Andrews discusses her new book, Where Are All the Community? Aboriginal Melbourne Revisited, published by La Trobe University Press, an imprint of Black Ink. Professor Andrews is in conversation with Professor of History at La Trobe, Kat Ellenhouse. Hello, everybody. Thank you all for coming, and it's wonderful to see such a huge crowd here to celebrate our wonderful Professor Julie Andrews and her book, and to kick off the first of this year's Launches at La Trobe events. This is part of the very vibrant programming that we have here. We have a lesser known but very important La Trobe literary programming group that runs the Launches at the Library events and also the Writers on Campus events. So do keep your eye out for the rolling program of events that are supported by School of Humanities and Social Sciences and the Library and University events. And we're grateful to everybody for their support. Part of the idea of these events is that it gets us together on campus in a way that, particularly since COVID, has been very difficult to do. We've all gotten so used to working from home, and we might chuff off to an event at the Wheeler Centre or a launch at Readings, but this gives us an opportunity to do so on campus, on our lunchtimes, and a great opportunity to talk across the silos of our own departments as well. So the strength of the numbers here today is a great indication that that's a program that is well worth supporting and continuing. We also have the terrific opportunity that all of these literary events are being recorded, hence the Muppet and the microphones, for the Literary La Trobe podcast, which, if you haven't had a listen yet, all of the literary events that have been programmed over the last couple of years by me as the Professor of Public Engagement, or by Kelly Gardner, who has been the convener of the Writers on Campus program, and that includes all of the events at the Bendigo Writers Festival for the 2 years that I was co-curator and it ran. Obviously, the year that I was co-curator and it didn't run, there's no audio for. But some other great events that we've had on off campus as well, including a sold out event that was at the State Library of Victoria a couple of years ago now, that was in conjunction with La Trobe's partnership with the Australian Ballet when they kicked off their Oscar performance. We had a terrific panel that included our honorary research associate Christos Tsiolkos. Dennis Altman, who I see in the crowd here, was the chair of that, and there's some people from Alexis Harley from our department, from the English and Creative Writing here, was on that. You'll find all of this. There's about almost 50 episodes now on the Literary La Trobe podcast, which is produced by our very own Matt Smith. So please do have a look at that, and while you're there looking at La Trobe podcasts, maybe have a look at the Archive Fever podcast, which again is sponsored by the Humanities and Social Sciences Department, hosted by myself and my colleague Eve Rees. We are in production with Matt Smith, our producer, on our 8th season at the moment. So somehow we've managed to get to 8 years of talking with other nerds about their passion for archives and research. Just this week, we recorded an episode with Geshe Lakdor, which was part of the La Trobe Asia programming here. We are very honoured to have the Dalai Lama's translator and interpreter, and now the director of the Tibetan Archives in Dharamsala here, and we interviewed him for the program. You'll be able to hear that later this year. But just a snapshot of the many exciting activities that are going on at La Trobe in this literary space and in the podcasting space. So now we have the first of our launches at the library, and are very pleased to be able to contribute to what's now been, I'd say, Julie, it's correct to say, the Festival of Julie and her book over the last couple of weeks. Julie had a launch at the Aboriginal Advancement League, a community launch, a launch at Readings last week, and now this is our opportunity to celebrate her and shine a light on her book here on campus, which is what this series aims to do, is to really spotlight and highlight the work that La Trobe authors are doing, both in academic publishing but also in their more general publishing. With that, I will hand over to our tremendous host for the day, my colleague, Professor Kat Ellinghaus of the History Department, and she will introduce Julie and conduct the interview today. There'll be time for questions afterwards, and then please do stick around for some refreshments and conversation with your colleagues. Over to you, Kat.
Thanks so much, Kat. I'd just like to begin by acknowledging that we're meeting today on unceded Wurundjeri land and acknowledge elders past and present and also any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people joining us today. It's such a huge honour, Julie, to be able to talk to you about this book. When I read it, I just felt the weight of, you know, the 20 plus years of scholarship and activism and community work that you have done. And I think those of you who've been able to see the book already will know that it's there in every page. It is really the book that Melbourne needed to have. I was thinking, honestly, it should be for sale at the airport bookshop, because I would like people to read it before they step out of Tullamarine and start walking around on these lands. It is a beautiful, incredible combination of broad brushstrokes about Aboriginal Melbourne, about the history of this place, interwoven with really personal, local stories, right down to individual voices of your family and of your community. And it's really an incredible piece of work. So it is my honour to be here today. This is Professor Julie Andrews. She's the director of Gabrabic Wurrawilla Wudja, the Indigenous Research Centre here. And she has been at La Trobe since she finished her PhD.
33 years.
So this is... Yeah. And that applause, I mean, that Julie's work at La Trobe is integral to all the work that we do here. The activism from the very beginning when you were a student through to your activism now has shaped this university into a place where we can do good, ethical, collaborative research, and that we can learn as academics and students about how best to honour Aboriginal Melbourne and in our own work and in our own lives. So, Julie, thank you for that. So first, how did the book start, Julie?
Okay, I should say thank you to La Trobe University and Black Ink for turning this into a book in the first place. This is a product of my research for my PhD, and that was a comparison with another research that was done in 1963 that constructed a social profile of Aboriginal Melbourne at the time. So what I did as a HDR student is I generated my own data and compared it with the 1963 data by Diane Barwick that constructed the social profile. But then my data showed a different Melbourne, but also I looked at what has changed and what's remained the same since 1963, which is why I had to put myself in the story, because I was observing a lot of things from the time I was born. Now, Barwick's PhD was released in 1963. I was born 1962. So a lot of the people that she spoke to in her PhD were related to me, or I knew in the community. I grew up with them. So it was important for me to make that connection with them, to show that their voices are connected to me. But also I thought Barwick's, because she did the, you know, anonymous approach and not identifying them, but I knew they were when I was reading them. And a lot of my family were in her research. So when I did my research, I went and visited all these people that I grew up with, and they didn't want to be anonymous. They wanted to have their name there so their families could see them and identify that they were part of the research. So that was very important for me, to give them that opportunity to have that choice. No one said they wanted to be anonymous, and everyone wanted to speak openly and honestly about their experiences growing up in Aboriginal Melbourne. But some of the data that I uncovered were very different to Diane Barwick's. Now, when Diane Barwick was doing her research, she wouldn't have had access to government records like we have today. So she missed out on a lot of categories of groups of our community that didn't have a voice, like the children that were being taken away and put into institutions at the time. There was no kind of access to data to track our people's employment and education opportunities at the time. So what she was pulling together was purely from a research form, and that the way that she wanted to construct this social profile. And what was resonating for me, though, are the voices. So, you know, that was much more interesting to me as a researcher to hear the people speak. I didn't think she did the rest very well. I kind of like thought she could have done better, but then, you know, everyone doing a PhD thinks that as well. So my PhD might have the same problems, but, you know, I kind of like wanted to have my people with me in my research.
And they are. I mean, my next question is about the way in which your book is just peppered through with the voices and the words of your family and of your community. And I wanted to ask you, how did you make that happen? Because that's not always easy, or is it easy?
I don't know. I kind of like feel their voices led me, they steered me. My life steered me in it as well.
Yeah.
So it was coming from a place, and my supervisor at the time is John Morton, when I first started. And he said to me, when I was looking at a PhD topic, he said to me, you know, you're in the box seat for this. You can be an insider. Not many people would have access to the community like you would. And you could do your research as, you know, simple as possible. And Barwick was in your community at the same time. So there was, he could see the opportunities for me as a, you know, young scholar starting to do a PhD. And I kind of like thought, yeah, I'll do that. And he made me understand that I was in a privileged position as an Aboriginal person here in Melbourne, where I could draw on all of my life skills and life experiences, community experiences, and put it into that research. The other advantage is that I was an insider of the community, which meant I didn't have to wait to be invited. I just went and saw them and told them, and they all wanted to be involved and help. And that's what we do in our community. We help each other. We help our young ones get up in their careers. We help our young ones get an education. We help each other if they're in trouble, if they're in jail, they're coming out of jail. We help them all, you know, it doesn't matter. We don't judge. So when I went out into my community, they said, yeah, I'll help you, you know, and they all wanted to, you know, and a lot of these people knew my mum, my grandmother, all my family, but they knew me too because I'd grown up in the community and they trusted me that way. And they knew that I wouldn't do them wrong.
I wondered about the phrase that's used throughout the book, Aboriginal Melbourne.
Mm.
And I just wondered if you could talk to us about what that phrase means to you.
Mm. Naming, isn't it? Like, it's always a big thing when it comes to place names and that. And, you know, is it an Aboriginal name? Is it an English name? But I didn't want to use Naam. Mm. And I'll tell you why. Because everyone that I interviewed, Naam wasn't around when I did my research, my field work. I didn't grow up with Naam either. So out of respect to those people that have passed away now that I interviewed, that's how I went to them. Let's talk about Aboriginal Melbourne. Mm. Naam wasn't around when I was doing my research, nor was it in Barwick's research. So I had to pick something that would be consistent to the past as well as the present. And also I wanted to use this to show white Melbourne, we're here, we haven't gone anywhere, and it fitted in with the where's all the community. So, you know, someone came up in the ag a few months or last year when the book first got started being published and said, I've ordered your book because I want to learn more about Melbourne Aboriginal community. So that's why I named it that, because it was more accessible to people to understand what the book was about. But also it was about not having a gatekeeper approach to the knowledge in the book, so people could feel welcomed to come in and read the book. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. This isn't on the list, but I want to ask it anyway. Okay. Sorry. You say in the book that you are a child of Aboriginal Melbourne. What did you mean by that? Can you talk more about that?
We were all at the Aborigines Advancement League at the Christmas trees, and all our elders looked after us. Everything that they set up at the Aborigines Advancement League was for our community and for the kids. So that's all been instilled in me, that all my elders have done is laid the pathway for all the future generations to come. So I was able to observe, witness, be on committees with my elders and all that kind of stuff. So yes, I am the one following my elders' footsteps. So that's why I say I'm a child of Aboriginal Melbourne. But it also connects to my auntie's poem in the book, you know, Child of the Dreamtime.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make that connection with Annie Hillis's poem, and it opens up, I am a child of the dreamtime.
Thanks so much, Julie. And this is connected to what you were just saying about where you were as a child. The role of women activists in your book is so strong. It's such a big theme. And I just wonder if you could tell me about the role of women in Aboriginal Melbourne, and perhaps a little bit also about I've just literally come from one of my classes, and we read your auntie's autobiography, If Everyone Cared, and I just wondered if you could talk about, I guess, the strength of Aboriginal women and their voices and, that.
So, Auntie Margaret, Auntie Marge, So in my family now, we've got four generations of writers now. So that's my great-grandmother, Auntie Marge Tucker, then my cousin who wrote The Sapphires, and then now me, but also Auntie Hillis Maris, who wrote Women of the Sun. So that's a long list of writing there. And if you look at it, it's all women.
Yeah.
Even Women of the Sun.
Yeah.
The Sapphires.
Yeah.
All that kind of thing. So when I talk about women, it's like all women that I've seen in the Aboriginal organisations fighting for our children, our kids, you know, getting them, you know, some kind of control back in their lives. But, you know, the women that I knew were Annie Merle, Jackamos, my grandmother, Geraldine Briggs. They've got buildings named after them at Monash Uni. And the reason they've got those buildings named after them is because they were travelling out there, pooling their money together for a taxi to get out there to meet in the law school and set up the Aboriginal Legal Service here. So I'm sorry, I can't remember. It's a father and daughter. Does it? Do you remember that? She was a lawyer and so is her father. So that's why they got the names of the building for students. It's student accommodation. But they're the kind of women that I grew up with that weren't staying home cooking meals and watching Days of Our Lives. You know, they were women that were networking. They were women that were turning up at the courts because they could see that the youth were being in court and no one was there to represent them. So they started going to the courts to sit inside and with the kids that are going up to the judge and that, so they could support them. Then they set up the Aboriginal Health Service because all these kind of like connections were important. It's part of the social profile of Aboriginal Melbourne, the things we need, education, housing and employment. You have those three things in place, the rest, if it's strong enough, will help sort out the other problems to come. So it was the women that were setting that up, but it was also the women that were networking, and they formed a women's network nationally. So that went national, and they travelled national as well, so they could go out and network with women in Broome, women in Townsville. That's why I ended up in Townsville. There was, you know, in Sydney, the Sydney Aboriginal Medical Service. That was with Aunty Naomi Mayers, so she set that up. But always men there, you know. Gary Foley was at the Redfern Aboriginal Medical Service working with my auntie. You know, there was always men there, but they never stopped the women from organising and doing their work, you know. They supported them. And some of those women, they used to go every Easter, and I was on the bus and we'd catch up and go up to Canberra and stay at ANU. And they'd have the Women's Network Conference there, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Women's Conference. And that was when the Tent Embassy was starting up with Gary Foley, you know, and they came in, there was five of them, Aboriginal men, to the Women's Conference and said, will you support us? And the women said yes, and they all got up, walked out, and they went down where they were. Before the Tent Embassy, you know, got famous and that. But they said, you know, will you support us? And they said, yes. That's what the women were like. We all help each other.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Julie. I wanted to ask you about the chapter on the Parkies. And you said, you say in the book that it was something you thought long and hard about, that particular chapter, and I just wondered if you'd tell us more about that chapter and what it means to you.
I wrote a publication from that chapter mainly because it captured so many people's attention. Also, a lot of those people have passed away now, and a lot of those people were in the institutions that Diane Barwick didn't get access to. And I made that connection when I was interviewing them. And I said, when were you taken? And they said, 1968, 1959. And my brothers were taken too, or my sisters. So there was this, you know, period, a decade there where I thought, she missed this. She couldn't get access to it. That's our data that wasn't in PhD. Those people were on the streets living as parkies, drinkers on drugs and living a hard life. But they all stuck together and they all knew their kinship and they knew who was who and who they were related to. And they were all related to me too. If they were Yorta Yorta, they were related to me somewhere or I knew their family. So I had, they're the most marginalised voices in Aboriginal Melbourne, because they're living on their own, they're not employed, they don't do the same stuff that we do, you know. But they've created their own system on the streets on how to live and manage and live with each other. And not, I presented the raw data, verbally, I didn't, with pictures, to social inquiry maybe 10, 15 years ago. And I talked about the hardcore living. They got their own language on the street, the way they identify things, the way they talk, but they all know what mission they come from. And that's the important thing about Aboriginal Melbourne. Everyone comes from somewhere and they know that connection and that's their identity. But once they're in Aboriginal Melbourne, there's another form of identity that gets constructed, which is all about being proud and belonging in Aboriginal Melbourne. Now, a lot of these people weren't born on country, so they're not going back to be buried on country. So Terry Garwood, who's in the book, got together. He's in the government, and they pushed for a actual cemetery for Aboriginal Melbourne, so our people can be all buried together. So they're the kind of things that are important to us, that matter to us as well. That once you go and you pass away, you're not going to be forgotten. So that's why I wanted to do the Parkies story, not only because I thought they deserved it, but because there was an element to them that people would appreciate. And we all know Archie Roach and Ruby Hunter and Jack Charles and all that. They all come from the streets there, where all the Parkies come from. They all used to drink with Archie and Ruby and Jack Charles. They used to do the drugs with them, with Jack. All that kind of thing. They knew each other inside and out. But when Jack and Ruby and Archie got famous, they were still there. So when I said to them in one of the interviews, now that Archie and Ruby are famous, what do you think? And they said, oh, they're still with us. They're still here. We love them. They're our brother and sister. They're with us in spirit. They'll always be with us. So with Parkies, there's a sense of belonging that you would never break, because it's something that only they experience. And when I said to my cousin, who's on the streets all the time, I said, what makes you a Parkie? And she said, life. Life makes you a Parkie. And when I showed her that quote, a couple of years ago, she went all shame.
Oh.
And she's saying, oh, what? And then I showed her all her interview transcripts. She went, oh, what? You know, so, but yeah, they really get into it now.
Mm. Yeah, I love the story you told at the readings launch about how the Parkies wanted to be interviewed together.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. Now, anthropology tells you not to do focus groups like that. But you couldn't stop the Parkies all coming in. You know, I remember that day my cousin brought them in. They were all my research assistants. And I'm looking, and there's about seven of them all walking together, men and women. And my cousin leading them. And she said, here they are, look. And they all sat there. And I had to do an interview with each one of them while they all watched. And then they'd be interjecting and, you know, saying, no, you're right. We're here, keep going, and all that kind of thing. So, yeah, that was a day I'll never forget.
Yeah. Okay. At the Readings launch as well, you know, you really talked through, Julie, something that I mentioned at the start, which is your extraordinarily long and amazing contribution to this place, to La Trobe University. And I want to ask you what you think can be done by the university in the future to follow through the lessons that you teach us in this book about how research should be done and about what needs to happen so that community is safe and, I guess, yeah, for, you know, the care and the love that's through this book. How can we make this university a place that honours all of those things?
Well, you know, La Trobe's got more than one campus.
Yeah.
So we've got Albury, Wodonga, Mildura, Bendigo, Shepparton, and all those people related to everyone here in Melbourne, and also to the Parkies. Mm. So there's this sense of responsibility for me to make these kind of developments at our regional campuses to make it better for our communities there as well. We probably have a lot of opportunities here in Melbourne. Our native title does a lot of other changing and shifting to the community structures that our people live under, and some have more benefits than others as a result of native title. So I'd like to see La Trobe University create opportunities for all our communities in the regional campuses as well as Melbourne. Funnily, I've been observing that this book has increased the confidence for our community and students and that to come to La Trobe now, because they're able to see that there's a sense of safety here for them, where their identity isn't going to get lost. We've been focusing on decolonising the curriculum since our first PVC, Indigenous Dennis McDermott, came here, that was one of his main goals, was to decolonise the curriculum. And what that means is to make it accessible for our people, not to take anything away from non-Aboriginal people, but to make it accessible for our people so we can have more qualified people in our communities to do good for our people. So that's what I'd like to see, is that we continue along that line and start churning out real graduates that can work in the community and make a difference, but also be connected to La Trobe. And I'd like more Indigenous academics at La Trobe, because it's damn hard being one. And ever since I got here, it's always been one of three in my stories. Or, you know, I'm the only Aboriginal female professor now in Victoria. So it's not just La Trobe. So there's, you know, we always have to, and this is what my elders did, they kept laying down the foundations, the pathways of understanding to open the doors for our people to come. Now, our people, when I started here, none would come on to universities. So we started like introduction programs for our community to bring them in to not feel scared of a university. That's not long ago. So, you know, 30 years ago, me and Wayne Atkinson and, you know, we had to bring the elders in. So we focused on the elders, bringing the elders in. We have functions, we'd have, you know, then we start having events in the Agora. Then we were supporting the Northland Secondary College. Then we'd bring in all the Aboriginal acts and venues. So Darebin City Council started coming in with us and they'd be ringing us. Do you want to, we got Warlpiri women, do you want to, you know, give them a gig out there? Yep, we'll take them. So it was always having that open door approach. But not only that, knowing your community and your culture and all the differences around Australia, so you don't have a preference for just one. You got to be inclusive of everyone, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander. So, you know, we've had so many acts come in when we were doing student activism, but it's that kind of thing where in the regional campuses, it's starting to get momentum, but we at our Aboriginal community controlled organisations, we still got to build that relationship, the bridging between Aboriginal communities and La Trobe.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Julie. I mean, we're in this state at the moment, we're in the treaty era, and so we have such an opportunity here to be a leader in this space, I think.
Can I just talk about that?
Yes.
So treaty, when I stopped this book, treaty, when I was doing my research, treaty wasn't, it was around. But when I closed this book, it was just after the truth-telling finished and we were moving into the treaty stage that we got now. Now we're moving into another stage. So I wanted to stop the book there because then someone else can pick it up and reflect on the treaty stage in comparison to what I wrote, you know. So that's what I did with Barwick's stuff. So I've left it open so someone else can come and talk about the treaty and what our community, our people did and what were the benefits and the racism that's going to come our way, guys. I'll tell you that now. You know, the next election, we see South Australia, what happened over there. You know, the racism in Australia for our people is real, you know. So we saw the yes vote, you know. Everything we try to set up, it gets knocked down. So this is another reason why I wanted the book to be Aboriginal Melbourne in that title. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks, Julie. All right. I just want to finish by thanking Julie for today, and we're going to do questions in a minute. It's not the end, but I just wanted to thank you for your extraordinary contribution to this university and to for this book. I think it's really wonderful. So. So we have time now for some questions from the audience. Claire, are you running this?
Yeah.
Excellent.
So throw your hand up. I'll give you this. Remember that this is being recorded for the podcast, so if you don't want your voice in any way implicated, let us know. But otherwise, throw your hand up and I'll bring you these mics. Good throwing, sir.
Both?
Both, please.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Julie.
Both mics.
Both mics like that? Yes, very good. I'm an anthropologist at La Trobe, and I've had the long benefit of being a colleague of Julie's and of sitting in supervisory sessions with you and learning from you, thinking that I thought I knew stuff about Aboriginal Victoria. I've done extensive research on native title in this state, and then I had an induction with you and I went, oh my God, I didn't know about that, I didn't know this, I didn't know the other, and it remains to this day one of the most important seminars I've ever sat in. So I want to thank you for that. And now I want to go to a problematic area, and that is Barwick's research. You know, I've spent a lot of time buried in that stuff. It's interesting, but it is indeed problematic. What's the status of her files now? Where are they kept and who has access to them?
Okay. State Library has all the raw data, but thankfully we have an Aboriginal person that's in charge there to stop people from accessing family records, the raw data. There's a lot of my family stuff in there. When she did the recordings, and this is what that time, that era, it was all about gossip, you know. Anthropology was looking what how these communities gossiped about each other, not about outside, not about Australia or racism. That it was like how they were running each other down and what were they all saying and who's sleeping with who and all this kind of stuff, you know. So she documented a lot of that, which is very, very sensitive stuff if you're looking back. Now, when I say sensitive, if someone died in your family and then you come across that stuff that they're saying, running them down or talking about this or that, or they're talking about your father or your mother or your grandmother, and she actually recorded all of that. Now, the thing there is that a lot of my aunts that were involved that she recorded overhearing. Now, what she used to do, this is her methodology, don't do this anymore, because she masqueraded that she was a researcher and didn't tell them that what she was writing it down. So she'd listen in on all the conversations and then write it down at the end of the day. Very bad for my family. And for women, because, you know, women just let it go, you know, talk about this one, that one, that one. And then she wrote it all down, you know. And who's to say they saw it? They didn't. So now they're kind of like, you know, we're trying to get them in to see. Is that'd be very traumatic for them. They were only like 19-year-old girls, a lot of the women back then. And she, what she was doing was doing sewing and pretending she was sewing or knitting or something like that while they're all talking and everything and hanging around with all the young ones. And then, you know, that's what I say about masquerading. She was actually doing research by, you know, pretending she was doing sewing, making them things and that. So for me, when I saw that in her journals, I thought she was the biggest, you know, like two-faced person. And if Aboriginal people knew what she was doing back then, a lot of the men didn't trust her. I know that much, that some of the men said, oh, yeah, I remember that one, you know. But it was mainly the women that gave her access, you know. And that was because Uncle Doug Nichols at the Aborigines Advancement League, Stanner was her supervisor. So Stanner organised for her to come down to the Aborigines Advancement League, which was the biggest thriving Aboriginal organisation in the country. So their political networks, their structure and everything went right up to Canberra. So that's why she came down and did her field work here. Now, she was Canadian and she's a historian, but she crosses over with anthropology now. But they use her a lot in native title today, especially with the Boonwurrung, Bunurong and the Wurundjeri, Woiwurrung, mainly because she published on the Narrangheta that all the men really love because it's about them. But I kind of like wonder if Narrangheta doesn't apply to women too. So what we see with Barwick's work is very much just a snapshot on her research. But I wonder, how do you make that balance for the women? Because a lot of the women with anthropology were silenced. Our stories aren't there. It's always about the men, and we know why, because of male anthropologists, but also the men would keep them away from the women. But the other thing is Aboriginal women's voices are very much controlled or not there at all. Or they're applied in a way where they're in a white system. They were working, they were, you know, that kind of thing. They're in a role or something. But their role as cultural women, or even their status inside their community and their families, are not there. So that's why, you know, in comparison with the Narrangeta, the Wurundjeri, Barrick and all that, Simon Wonga, the balance with women isn't there. But a lot of that stuff came from Barwick. It came from all these early historians that, I don't know what happened there. Maybe you can research that. But yeah, there is, for me, that's why I really focus on the women a lot and their strength, because, you know, they always said, nah, that's white journals. They're white man's words. We don't follow that. And that's how I was brought up.
Hi, thank you so much, first. I was wondering how you navigated including the personal in an academic work, how you were able to take your lived experience and your community life and pair it.
Yeah, thank you for asking that question. Right now we talk a lot about Indigenous-led in Gabrabik, Warrawolla Wadja Research Centre. And Indigenous-led research means having the Aboriginal voice, the Aboriginal ways of knowing, the constructed identity that you get from your community and your people and your cultural, being able to apply your cultural knowledge. But with me, I was able to have that dual ways of thinking in an academic framework, as well as putting my cultural knowledge and community and family upbringing and the community that I knew into that framework. But I couldn't, it came naturally. I didn't let anything take away from my community or my people, probably because I've got such a strong Aboriginal upbringing and I've been taught so much. I've been exposed to a lot of things too. I've had a lot of education experiences, 12 schools, so I said in the book, and I went to the Black Community School in Townsville with Uncle Eddie Mabo and Auntie Netta Mabo, his wife. So I was taught a lot, and a lot of the women were political activists in my family. So yeah, I think it just was something that was instilled inside me when I write. And if I look at my other family writings, they're the same. But I did look at Barwick's writings, and she had that particular framework and style as well, where she was, you know, putting the academic in with the voice. Yeah.
Julie, I have one that I might follow up with that then. You'd been talking about trust building, and that so much of your research was able to be done not just because you're within the community, but you have the trust of the community. I'm wondering how that sits alongside university policies and procedures, in particular ethics procedures. Many of us have had to grapple with university ethics committees. Whether you follow university ethics procedures or your own mob ethics in the interviews in the book.
I went through ethics to do this research. I didn't tell my community, but I do remember going to the parkies and saying, oh, I had to do a protocol thing before I got here to talk to you. And they said, what protocol? I said, there's a cultural protocol that we have to do before we can come and talk. That's not about us, is it? And they said, nah, what? And they rejected that. But here in my work here, ethics, I'm on the committee here. I'm a, like, expert one, though I haven't got that much time, but we keep an eye on it. But I'm also on the VACHO ethics because of VACHO is the Victorian Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation. So they're approached by universities in Victoria a lot to do research. So I'm on the ethics committee there, but they don't know what's going on inside a university. So it was interesting for me to be able to draw the, you know, tell, point out things that they weren't thinking of that we do here at La Trobe. But the other thing with the ethics for our people is that they really make it complicated in terms of how we can participate. So we've got to decolonise that process as well. So it is, that's the importance of decolonising. So it's not just about curriculum, it's systems, it's procedures and all that kind of thing. So our community will participate. So that's one of the things that we talk a lot about inside the research centre. And being with VACHO, who, you know, Jill Gallagher is our patron and she's the CEO of VACHO, she's so quick when it comes to understanding the, you know, frameworks, but what's going to work and not work for our people. And that's where I take that same kind of approach. I remember Jill at a forum being asked about something. How did you learn? She goes, there's no book. There's no book. There's no framework. We just know our community. So we know what they need. So that's the importance of Aboriginal organisations, that we have to have the Aboriginal organisations so we can make a difference, but also they've got the data.
Hi, thank you so much. So my name is Bruno. I'm a lecturer at the law school, and I'm teaching a subject called Justice and Society this semester. And my lecture, my tutorial today is about land and justice. And one of the things we're discussing is the Doctrine of Terra Nullius and then the Mabo case and Native Title. But in the second part of the lecture, what I want students to do is to engage with the Uluru Statement from the Heart and with the treaty in Victoria to think about new, you know, the future of the relationship between Australia or Victoria and Indigenous communities in Australia. And I know this might sound like a vague question, but what would you add to this tutorial if you were to be teaching the tutorial, or a message would like to leave to mostly, I think, 100% non-Aboriginal Australian students? Yeah, just anything you would like to say, because they might listen to this in the podcast, because I've already recommended to them. Thank you.
You're dealing with some big issues there, and they're unfinished business. So I would ask the students, how do you see this being unfinished business, and what can be done to make this in some kind of way meaningful to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people? The biggest hardship for our people is the investment of our time, our hopes, and teaching our people and young ones, have a go, let's support this. Then it just disintegrates in front of our eyes. How do we come back from that? You know, so that's what I mean by unfinished business, that every time we get our hopes up that we're going to get something for our people as a result of colonisation, it gets taken away. And maybe that's what you can ask the students to think about.
Thank you so much, Julie. Please, before I say some concluding remarks, please thank Professors Andrews and Ellinghouse for their contributions as well.
You've been listening to Literary La Trobe, a La Trobe University podcast produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land. You can find out more about this podcast and other La Trobe University podcasts on the La Trobe University website.